Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome, welcome out there to our Blog Talk Radio friends who are dialing from all over the world. We want to welcome you this morning to Off the Shelf, whether you're listening here or Rainbow Soul or however you're tuning in to Off the Shelf on this morning. And I just like to let you know some people who tune in our show, it's their first time coming across it. They'll come across at the beginning or middle looking for a podcast to listen to or something that when they search Off the Shelf comes up. I just want to let you know that, yes, you are listening to the winning book radio show, Off the Shelf. I want to welcome you. Welcome to this Saturday, December the 15th. Those of you who celebrate Christmas, that clock is ticking. You do not have long, but want to thank you for joining us. And I want to leave this thought with you before we go into this morning's show and introduce to you today's guest and sit back and see what she has to share with us, not only about herself as a writer, but her books and the process, her journey here thus far. But the thought I wanted to leave is from Thomas Edison, and it is, our greatest weakness lies in giving up. The most certain way to succeed is always to try just one more time. Our greatest weakness lies in giving up. The most certain way to succeed is always to try just one more time and be open to change. Sometimes when you try again, you got to shift something, do something a little differently so you can get a different outcome. But we know when we really want something, we will find a way to get it. My next question to you, Off the Shelf listeners, and to our loyal listeners, you know what's coming next. I have to ask you, how good of a mystery sleuth are you? I like mysteries, and this is why detective stories and you think about the people who write those detective type mystery stories, and the Agatha Christies and people who, Walter Mosley, I remember his early books, the mysteries in his stories. It could be three or four people, and all the characters are so intriguing. You're glued into each character, what made them become the way they are, what motivates them, what are their intentions, and then something happens. Something gets stolen, somebody does somebody wrong, or a murder, as happens in Love Pour Over Me. And now you've gotten close to all these characters, as though you meet somebody at work, a friend, somebody in your family, and then this happens, and one of these people is involved. Now, who is it? This is what you get to figure out in Love Pour Over Me. And while you figure that out, you also get to see Raymond and Brenda, who are meant to be together. But it is not so simple what happens to them, because Raymond was raised by his father, which is honorable. He stayed when his mother left when Raymond was only two, but his father has untreated alcoholism. So he's done a noble thing. He hasn't abandoned his son, but there's been a lot of damage from that. So here's Raymond, an only child. He goes to college. He meets Brenda. He is a middle distance track phenom on his way to the Olympics. All this coming together with his four friends who have a bond that lasts a lifetime. But which one of them is responsible or involved in this murder? And then what's going to happen to Raymond and Brenda and these friends? This is a great reason, if you love these things and you like mystery, to get a copy of Love Pour Over Me. And you can get it in ebook or in print copy. If you don't see it on the store shelf, just ask the clerk to get you a copy of Love Pour Over Me by Denise Turney, and they can get you a copy because it's carried by the largest book distributors in the world. I hope you will treat yourself right now to a copy of Love Pour Over Me. And now let us go and meet our very special off-the-shelf guest. Oh, I'm telling you, 13 years, every show I learn something that I never knew before, or I see something differently from every single guest who has been on this show. I'm telling you, it's very enriching, which is why I encourage you again to set your dial to off-the-shelf, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Saturday morning. And our special off-the-shelf guest this morning is Colleen Parkinson. Colleen is an award-winning author of the plays The Injured Child and Waiting for the Train. I love her titles. And Colleen is also a blogger and a book reviewer. Publications that she's written for, written book reviews for, include The Mississippi Rag, digging on this title, The Finest Hat in the Whole Wide World. Wouldn't that title pull you in? The Finest Hat in the Whole Wide World is Colleen's debut novel. In addition to writing, other interests that Colleen has include American history, genealogy, literary classics, and music. And Colleen has a special fondness for music, from particularly music from the 1920s through the 1940s. And I encourage you to check Colleen out online at thefinesthat.jimdo.com. 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 Welcome to Off the Shelf, Colleen.
Hi, Denise. It is really a pleasure to be with you this morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, excited to have you. We're going to have lots of fun, and our listeners are going to glean so much. When they walk away, they'll say, oh, my goodness, I'm glad I tuned in Off the Shelf this Saturday morning. Now, the first few questions I ask every single guest, just to give our listeners some backstory before we just jump right into talking about their books. So can you tell Off the Shelf listeners, Colleen, where you grew up and what life was like for you growing up?
I grew up in Pleasant Hill, California, which is a suburb in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I grew up in a traditionally dysfunctional family, like most Americans. And everything negative that happened to me, I was able to turn into a blessing. I always wanted to just be better than my circumstances, and that's what I've worked for all of my life.
Do you have siblings?
Oh, yes. I'm number 7 out of 8 children. And my mom and dad were divorced when I was 4, and our mother raised us. And we were very poor. I was raised in the 1960s. So it was before there were a lot of social programs available to help single mothers. And so we were very poor. And there was always that stigma at school because our clothes were old and out of style. And we got bullied because of it. And it was just hard at home, very, very hard. And my oldest brother actually quit school at 14 to go to work to help support the family.
14. Wow.
Yeah.
It's funny how we look at people and we just look at somebody and think, oh, I bet you had it easy, and you have no idea what the person went through in their life. I love how you said you always wanted to make yourself rise above your circumstances and do better,
mm-hmm.
rather than let your circumstances determine the path for your life and say, see, this is why I'm like this. But you decided not to take that approach, but to rise above it. And I commend you for that. What did you dream of becoming, Colleen, when you were a kid?
This is funny. My first love was acting. And I spent a lot of time in school plays, acting in productions. And I even wrote some small plays when I was still in junior high school. And my second love was writing. And when I was very young, when I was 9 years old, I was in the hospital for 3 months. And all I had to do in the hospital was write. So I started writing short stories, and the doctors and nurses used to read them and pass them around to the other staff at the hospital. So I became the writer in residence there. And they encouraged me to keep writing, and my teachers did. So I ended up, after spending a lot of years in local theater and doing industrial films in my adult life, I ended up returning to writing as really my first love. I knew that was what God wanted me to do.
So you started out acting. You know, it's uh-huh. interesting when I listen to, and we've had a few guests on, some who are actresses and movie producers, but a lot of people don't. They start out wanting to do something different than what they end up doing. But I think it's good that you explore, let yourself explore what you wanted. Now, how old were you? You said you went back to writing, you started out acting, and you were involved in it. How old were you when you just absolutely knew that you wanted to be a writer?
I think I was 14. No, actually, let me take that back. I was 12. And that's when I really knew, and I started writing really bad novels at 12, 13 years old. And you know, when you don't have life experience, it's not going to be quality work, but it's honing the craft. And when I retired from my day gig, I took to writing full time. And wrote a series of novels that I never published. But those novels, this particular series that I wrote, helped me exorcise some demons in my life. So it was therapeutic. And on the other side, too, on the other part of the plus side, was that it helped me really hone my craft. And so after I put that series aside, I got into my family genealogy, and that's where my book, The Finest Hat in the Whole World, came from. It was inspired by a mystery that I uncovered during my genealogy.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, we got to get into that. We have got to get into that. So you were young, 14 years old. You know, let me ask you, did you think those early books you wrote when you were a kid, did you think, oh, this is the best book and it's going to be a bestseller?
No, never did.
Oh, you did?
Never did. Because I knew that I was an avid reader, so I knew that I didn't have the quality. So I know I wasn't ready, but it was all the process of learning and, learning and polishing up the craft. It's like playing a piano or a musical instrument. You have to, you never start off being great at it. You start off making mistakes and keeping with that instrument and practicing every day, and writing's the same way.
You know what?
So,
the fact that you didn't think that, because kudos for you that you knew, okay, this is just a part of the process, that you
yes.
knew that. Who or what you were, an avid book reader, who or what inspired your passion, your love for books?
Oh, my passion, my love for books. Probably when I was really young, when I first read Little Women, I was probably about 8 years old, and I read Little Women. We didn't have a television that worked when we were growing up, so we had lots of books, and I was always at the library getting new books. And the first one that really, though, inspired me to be a writer was The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton. It was a fantastic book, and I noticed that she had written it at 17, and I said, oh, my gosh, if I could do that, if I could write something like that that grips people, like her book did, then I knew I would be on the right track.
Okay.
So she inspired me.
I have to ask you, and you kind of jumped into it, which I'm glad that you did. But first I want to ask you, before I get into the funnest hat in the whole wide world, which did you start writing first? You were wanted to be into acting. Did you start writing plays or novels? When you first put your hand to it, what was the first thing that you did?
I wrote short stories first. And when I was in elementary school and junior high school, the school would have little projects for us, and the kids would always look to me to be the writer for the short skits and plays that we did. And I remember one class where we actually did an exercise doing radio plays. Back in the 30s and 40s, radio plays were the big thing. And the teacher thought it would be fun for us to do radio plays and tape them. And none of the kids knew what radio plays were, but I did. And so I put all of that together and taught everybody about sound effects. And so it was really a cool thing, because it gave me a chance to mix theater and writing together for the first time then. So, you know, anyway, it was just, you know, another part of my growing experience as a writer.
What is their special meaning? You told us you were studying genealogy, which I find very interesting. We know what
yeah.
it did for Alex Haley's career, and he probably really kicked this off with Roots. But you were studying genealogy, and you came
mm-hmm.
across a mystery in your family, and that's where the finest hat in the whole wide world comes from.
Yeah. Oh, the book title is actually The Finest Hat in the Whole World.
Oh, okay, in the whole world.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I noticed it was on your website as The Whole Wide World, and it's easy for that to happen. Other people have called it that as well. But it's actually The Finest Hat in the Whole World. And getting back to your question on the genealogy, what got me started on genealogy was the fact that I wanted to find out where things went wrong in my family. How did everything get so messed up? And my father knew very little about his family background. And what he did know, he didn't want to talk about. And one day I asked him to tell me, you know, what he did know about his family. And what it turned out to be was he was really estranged from his brothers and sisters, and there had been a rumor that he had another sister, but he didn't know anything about her, had never met her, and didn't even know for sure where she was living or what happened to her. And about 10 years after my dad passed away, I went on Ancestry.com and started delving into my family history, and found that my dad's side of the family were Revolutionary War heroes and Civil War. We were all Union in the Civil War. Absolutely would not own slaves. It was one of those things in my family where you didn't do that. So we were Union people during the Civil War. And then as I got closer to the 20th century, I was researching census forms, and I found that my aunt, this sister of my dad's who had disappeared from the family, I found out that she was living with her uncle instead of with her parents. So there was this family mystery, because she had, my aunt had four other siblings, and she was the one that was given away to go live with her uncle and grandmother. So there was this mystery about why this happened. And she was only 6 years old when they sent her away to go live with her uncle. And it haunted me the whole time. And I actually found her grave site and all the family plot. And a funny thing happened when I went to her grave site. She was in a mausoleum. She had been cremated. I think, is mausoleum the right word? Or I think it's a different word. But I couldn't see in this big room where all these cremains were in, you know, embedded in the wall. And something told me to turn around and look behind me and then look up. And I did, and there she was. There was her niche. And I felt that she was right there beside me after that. And when I started thinking about the relationship between her and her uncle. And the thing I found out through my research was she ended up having a far better life because of him than my dad and his siblings had with staying with their parents. So her uncle made all the difference in the world to her. And in my imagination, I started thinking, you know, there's some kind of a story here. So the finest hat in the whole world was inspired by my aunt and her uncle. It's not their real story, but they inspired the book. And I tell you, every moment I was writing it was an absolute joy. And I felt them, you know, watching over my shoulder many, many nights when I was writing. So that's how it came about.
The finest hat in the whole world. Can you give off-the-shelf listeners like a synopsis? We know how it came about, what you shared. You started studying. You wanted to know what is going on in my family, what is causing these things to happen,
yes.
And then you find out about your aunt. Can you give us a brief synopsis? And also, is this a work of fiction that is kind of like
it's
based on your family? Or?
Right. It's a work of fiction inspired by their relationship.
Okay. Can you give us a brief synopsis of the...
Sure. Brief synopsis. It takes place between the years 1917 and 1937. So it covers a 20-year time span. The main character is Des, who is a bartender in this little town out in the Sacramento Valley. And he's a recovering alcoholic. He leads a very empty life. He's still at home taking care of his mother. And his brothers are gone and have families of their own. And his oldest brother sends him a telegram and says, "I'm bringing Fina." Fina is the name of the little girl. To come stay with you. And Fina is a very troubled child. She's very volatile, temperamental. She sees everybody as her enemy. And it turns out that she was very abused at home. Her mother could not handle her. So the mother sends her away to live with her uncle Des. And Des wants to adopt her after he has her for so long. And, you know, eventually she ends up staying with him. And their relationship is one where they become very emotionally dependent on each other, but at the same time, they're healing each other. And he gives her chances in life that she wouldn't ordinarily have. He encourages her to stand up and be a strong woman and depend on herself and work for a living and to be an honorable person. And he, in the meantime, is battling his own demons. He was responsible for a death in his family, and that's haunted him all of his life. And she really, you know, comes to him and helps him settle all these demons that he has. And so basically, they kind of end up in a 20-year time span healing each other and moving forward. But it's not to say that it was all sunshine and lollipops. She was a very difficult child to raise. But they get through things. And he has other family, a brother that is very wayward and is kind of the family embarrassment. And that brother ends up marrying a Chinese woman. And he doesn't realize how much racial prejudice there is in their area, you know, because it's the 1920s by then, you know, until he marries this Chinese woman and can't take her all the places he could have taken other people. And it occurs to him that, you know, that he never saw it until he married her, how difficult it was for people of other races there to have the same privileges as the general population. So am I getting confusing here from running through too many different
No. And that's a good topic even today. It's timeless. We don't, whether it's a racial or a health issue or somebody is extremely poor or extremely wealthy, we don't know what it's like if we're not immediately impacted by it, directly impacted by it. We don't know. We don't know until it happens to us or we have to, but we think we know.
Right. Right. And that's how this wayward brother gets his reality check, and he matures through that. And you know, his first comment when he realizes the racial divide, it's what's wrong with people? Because he didn't have a bone in his body that was prejudiced against anybody. And so there's all these elements in The Finest Hat in the Whole World that play into this time span. There's also the book also takes place during World War I, which was, you know, our first war with Germany. And we have a German character who is a love interest for Death, the main character.
Oh.
And she also undergoes a lot of victimization because she's a German immigrant. And people don't trust her, and they make fun of her accent. So there's that element, too, that, you know, it isn't only a skin color thing, but when you've got a war going on, everybody that's different is an enemy. So it touches on a lot of social things that were happening during that era between 1917 and 1937 during the Depression. But it shows that we can go ahead.
No, go ahead. It shows that we can
come through these difficulties and be better for it and teach others in the process.
Where is the story set at? And then I want to ask you a little bit more about Death and Fina. So the story is set in what?
It's set in California in what we call the Central Valley of California. It's close to Sacramento.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's kind of Central California near the Sacramento area. There's a lot of references to the river. And the towns I created are fictional towns based on the towns in that area.
What is Mr. Des Stewart like? How would you describe him? And does he have other children, or is Fina the only child he's taken care of? And it sounds like he's a single man.
Yes, Des is a single man. His heart was broken when he was very young by Fina's mother. He was in love with Fina's mother at one time. And so he's had a bitterness towards his oldest brother for taking Fina's mother away from him when he was young. And Des deals with chronic depression, a lot of guilt, but he betters himself through all of that with Fina's encouragement too. And he ends up, you know, being a warehouse manager at a paper products company, and he's moving up the ladder. So he overcomes his issues, but he never wants to really marry. He's become shy of all that kind of thing because he was hurt so bad. So he never got over that pain.
How old is Fina when she comes to him?
Fina is 9 years old when she comes to live with him.
Oh, she's young. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And how old is Des when he takes her in?
Des is 30 years old.
Oh, he's young
too. And still living with his mom. He's taking care of his mother, who is very, very old and is going blind and slipping into senility. So he has to work close to home within running distance of his house, basically, in case she has an emergency, which is why he's stuck being a bartender for so long, because the saloon is within walking distance of his house.
You
so
are
he,
bringing
he
in
always feels trapped.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm enjoying what you're sharing. It's bringing his story alive.
He's trapped by his circumstances, and he just feels like his life is hopeless, and that things will never change, things will never get better. And then Fina comes along, and they both find that there's a better way to do things and a better day ahead.
What is she like now? Why would her aunt, a little precious 9-year-old, why would her aunt say, you said her aunt, and what, okay, so what happened?
Oh, was her mother.
Oh, her mother.
Yeah.
Why would her mother, who Des, this was really a web here, Des was in love with Fina's mother. She would have been his daughter anyway if that had worked out, but it didn't. His brother took her. Now he's raising a daughter who would have been his if things had gone the way he wanted anyway. But what is Fina like that her own mother says, I can't raise you? What is she like that her own mother would say that?
Well, there was an issue. When Fina was born, Fina was born under very difficult circumstances, and Fina's mother has mental health issues, and she has many nervous breakdowns. She's a woman who was trapped in a life she didn't want with a bunch of kids. And so she's a violent mother. She can't handle, especially Fina. Fina is especially quick to fight and very temperamental, and so they clash and they fight, and the mother finally says, I can't handle her. I just want her out of here. She's driving me crazy, basically. And that's apparent right in the beginning of the book, that I think it's in the second chapter of the book where we learn the circumstances why Fina has been sent to live with her uncle.
Okay.
And
so her mother.
Yeah.
Her mother
can't handle her.
Okay.
Yeah.
She sends her away.
She
has other children, so she sends her to live with Des. How much research did you're going back, you know, and people who like historic books, some people love historic books. They learn from them. They just are a historian, and they like those types of books that go back. And they can tell, like, if you say, well, so-and-so was in a diner, and you say something about the diner, they know history so well, they can say, people didn't use that type of silverware back then, or they didn't have those type of glasses. So how much research did you do? You were already researching your family genealogy, so you probably came up with a lot of things from that. But how much research did you do as you revisited that time that the novel was set in?
Yes. Basically, the research I did was on the vehicles at the time, the most popular vehicles. There were areas in California where cars and horses and buggies were still being used together. And I did have to research the lingo of those eras. It was the lingo of the late teens, and then the lingo of the 20s and the lingo of the 30s, because things change over, you know, every generation has their language. So I researched that. I researched, even though I had family photographs to go by that I found over the internet, I researched men's clothing styles in particular, and you know, learned that in the early days, men's collars weren't attached to their shirts like they are nowadays. The collar was put on separately and could be taken off, and I thought that was really cool. And men didn't wear belts. In those early days, they wore suspenders. Belts hadn't been invented yet. And there was no such thing as a wristwatch until the early 1920s. So every man had a pocket watch, and every man carried a pocket knife. And so there were things like that. I knew pretty much enough about women's fashions, but it was the men's clothing that I really had to get into and learn about. And I also researched the music of the time to make sure that the song references, there's lots of references to music in the book. So I researched dates to make sure that they were correct time-wise with the book.
You sort of led into my next question, and this happens so often when I'm interviewing guests on Off the Shelf. It just always surprises me, but it happens over and over. I was going to ask you about music. So do you think that your love of music from the, you know, the 1920s through the 40s, you like music in those periods especially, but do you think that love for music during that time period inspired your writing in any way?
Absolutely. Yes, and you know, I actually on my website I have links to the music used in the book that the characters particularly liked and played on their phonographs, and so listeners could have a chance to actually go to my website and click on a link to YouTube to hear the music referenced in the book as the characters would have heard it back in the 20s or the 30s.
And then my next question is, as a writer, did you play for other off-the-shelf listeners who might be interested in writing, this they might find as helpful, or you or maybe you didn't use it, maybe you would find it distracting, I don't know, but did you play music from the early 1900s while you wrote The Finest Heaven?
No, I never play music or have any kind of noise in my background when I'm writing because it's very distracting. And I'm just one of those people that needs quiet when I'm working. But music inspires me, and I'll hear a piece of music that will inspire me in a scene that I'm going to write later. So music has always been an important part of my writing process. I've gotten ideas for stories and books just listening to a piece of music. I have a particular piece of music by the composer William Grant Still. It's called Mother and Child, and that inspired me to write my next book that I'm working on now. So music, yeah, definitely can put a picture in our minds and put a story in our hearts if we take the time to just listen and let it sink into us and envelop us. Every song has a story, has an inspiration behind it, and can be inspiring in its own way.
Yes. Now, what have readers been saying about The Finest Hat in the whole world?
Oh, I've gotten so much positive feedback. It really makes my heart feel good after all the hard work I put into it. But one of my favorite quotes was from a reviewer who said, "Every character is so well drawn. They are printed, they are painted in a technicolor of words." I just love that. And characterization is so important to me, to have strong characters, well-defined characters. If the reader does not care about the characters, they won't read the book. It'll be boring to them. The reader must have characters that they can root for. So that was a big thing for me. And I love it when people tell me about how it has affected them emotionally. And one person told me that it made them laugh and cry and feel like they were there.
Wow.
And when they closed the book after reading the final page, it was like saying so long to, you know, friends that they had made along the way.
That's what
I want as a writer. That's how I want the reader to react.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that emotional get into the story. The characters feel real, even just listening to you talk about The Finest Hat in the whole world, this story is extremely intriguing. Can you tell us, now you've written other, you're working on a novel now, but can you tell us about your play, The Injured Child? What drives the story, The Injured Child?
The Injured Child was about child abuse. It was about a little girl and her brother growing up with an alcoholic parent. And there is a mystery as to the disappearance of the girl's brother. It was an award-winning play. And when it was first put on, the producer wasn't sure if it would bring in an audience, but she wanted to take a chance on it. And what happened was after opening night, it played to standing room audiences because it affected so many people who were also, children of alcoholics and children who had grown up in violent families. So it hit home for so many people that the word got out about it. And crew of the story.
Oh, you put it on. It's not just a play. You actually put this on.
Yes, it was produced. Oh, yeah. And it won a Shelley Award and a Brandy Award. So we, you know, it was, I was really proud of that when it all was said and done.
Congratulations. It was produced. Congratulations.
Yes.
Why do you think that you, like J.K. Rowling with the Harry Potter books, why do you choose to focus on the child in the story? A lot of times the child is kind of dismissed. It's the adult that gets the spotlight in a book. Why do you think that you focus on the child in the story?
Because children are much more complicated than some people realize. Children see, feel, hear, and perceive things much more deeply than they're given credit for. And I love the idea of a child who is damaged growing up and overcoming that damage, working through it, and later on, you know, using what he or she has learned from that to make her or his life better, and to use it as a tool also to heal others along the way, because they've been there too and they know what it is. It's made me, you know, my own upbringing has made me a more compassionate person. And even though it was rough and often brutal, I would not trade it for anything in the world, because it's made me the person I am. And it's made me a better person. So that's why I write about children.
The way you responded to what happened to you, because some people go through the same situation and become bitter or extremely violent and angry or turn too far inward. Your choices were, you said at the start of the show, you wanted to overcome or be rise above the circumstances you started out in.
Yes.
And I said this at the start of the show. I love the titles of your books. You come up with great titles. Can you introduce us to your play, Waiting for the Train?
Waiting for the Train was inspired by a painting I saw of a woman in a train station, just sitting by herself on a bench. And Waiting for the Train is about a young boy who has been expelled from military school, and he's on his way home. And he gets off the train at the wrong station, accidentally, on purpose, you know. And he meets this woman who is also waiting for a train there. And she's on her way to Hollywood. She wants to be the next Betty Davis. And the play takes place on the night America found out Glenn Miller's plane had been shot down. It was during World War II. And so it takes place in 1942, actually. And the two characters are very affected by this when they find out that the plane has gone down. But they also it's been so long since I've actually seen the play, but it turns out that she actually was a ghost that was there that whole time.
Wow.
That he was talking to. And she was there to get him to go home, because he wasn't going to go home after being expelled from military school. He was afraid to go home. And
did
she made him realize.
That is so, the concept you come up with. Did he know, did he at any point realize she was a ghost?
Not until he was an adult, and he went to visit the train station later as an adult. And then he found out that she had died long before. he had ever sent it. And there was a photograph of her. So that's how he found out she was actually a ghost.
Oh my goodness!
And her job was to teach him the importance of family and the fact that in the blink of an eye, everything that is important to you can be gone, just like Glenn Miller and his plane that was shot down over the Atlantic that night.
What you talked about characters earlier. We have 10 minutes left in today's show. You talked about characters and that, you know, readers have to care about the character. You can't just be a phenomenal plot. They have to care what's going to happen to the characters
right.
in the book. What writing process do you follow to develop your characters? Do you do outlines? Do you have your characters write letters or write in a journal? Do you do character sketches? How do you flesh your characters out?
Well, this is a funny thing. I gave up on doing outlines because it never works out that way. The characters, in my experience, and other writers will tell you this, the characters tend to take over the project after a while and start writing it their way. I have a basic idea of each character and what their issues are. And what kind of people they are. But once I start the writing process, the characters themselves take over and flesh out. They flesh themselves out. And sometimes they will take the story in a different direction than I originally intended, and it ends up being a better story because of it. So I welcome my characters to just take over, and they're like little invisible entities of their own that just step off the page and say, hey, we're going to do it our way. So
do you ever have dreams?
That's what happened.
Do you ever have dreams
Pardon?
Where your characters tell you? Do you ever have dreams where your characters tell you something that should happen to them in the story?
No, I've never had dreams where they've talked about the story, but there have been times when I've had dreams of people that were characters but I can never remember the conversations. That's the funny thing. It doesn't happen often. I think it's happened 3 times to me during, you know, the last few years when I've been writing seriously. And I never remember the conversations. I just remember that I was having a conversation with this character in a dream.
And so you have written plays, you've produced plays or a play, and
I've written them,
the storyline is so rich in your stories. Can you share 3 to 4 steps that you take, Colleen, that you found to be effective at getting the word out about your stories and your books? Because to write a great story is one thing, but then you have to make sure that this great story finds its right readers, because it will really have an impact on these people's lives. They're the people who should be reading the story. What do you do to help connect your story to the people who are supposed to read it, to readers? What 3 to 4 steps have been effective for you at doing that?
Well, I definitely use social media. Thank God for social media. I've done Facebook advertising. I have a webpage and a blog, and my blog will often tackle issues humorously in my blog, and I always put notices out when I have a new article written for my blog. As far as promoting the book, I have a webpage specifically for the book, both on Facebook and then my individual webpage for it. And marketing, I've used Facebook marketing, and
so social
Amazon.
Amazon.
Social media. And my book is, you know, it's available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and Google Books, Kobo, Book Baby. Walmart even has it on their website. So I just get the word out, and I use social media for that. This is where you can find this book. And the ebook is priced at only $2.99, so it's very affordable.
Which has been more effective for you, Amazon ads or the social media?
Social media, definitely. But Amazon has my biggest sales have been through Amazon because that's where people will go first.
Mm-hmm.
Barnes & Noble, I'm finding, has been a very good source, and Google Books and Kobo, especially for the ebooks.
Okay.
I do want to put it out there for Book Baby, who published the book for me. They have done a great job just formatting the book to where it's available in all these different media types, ebook, print book. They've been great to work with.
Can you tell us, you said you're working on a new story. We only have a few minutes left, but can you give us a glimpse into what your new book, what you're working on now?
Yes, my new book, and here we go again, it's called Getting Through. And what it deals with is everybody in this story has dealt with death in one way or another. And it focuses on two teenagers who have each lost a parent. And they are cleaning up a cemetery, and an old cemetery, like a pioneer cemetery. And there are things that happen connected with the cemetery. They uncover a murder victim, and they delve into that mystery of who murdered Guy and why. And so it's kind of a mystery and a ghost story at the same time, but it's also talks about bullying and things that go on, you know, that teenagers deal with. It takes place in the early 2000s.
Okay. And that's coming out. When is that going? Can we expect to see that out so people can pick up a copy of it?
It's going to be probably another year and a half. I'm still working on it, and I'm going to be polishing it up and revising it before I feel it's absolutely ready to go.
Okay.
But
now, you told us.
Story now. Yes.
You told us your books are on ebook and in print, and they can get them on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, some Walmart, Google Books, Kobo, et cetera. And then is The Finest Hat in the Whole World, is that the one that's $2.99 ebook?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you tell us on what you said, social networks? You're out there. That's how you market your books. That's how you introduce your books to their readers. What are some of the social networks where people can find you at?
Social networks, Facebook, obviously. And I belong to some of the writers' pages on Facebook, like AIM out of Oregon. It's called Authors Innovative Marketing, and they go by the letters AIM. They have a website on Facebook, and they're very helpful to writers. And I also have done some book signings, and that helps. And another thing I do, I actually traveled to Hollywood Burbank and distributed a few books to people who were interested in learning more about it. I occasionally I will leave bookmarks and cards with advertisements for the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'll leave those in places where people will read.
Okay.
So anything, you know, any place where I can catch a reader's eye, I will leave some kind of little advertising.
You know, and one thing I'm learning, one way for us, a lot of writers don't like to market. If you look at it as you wrote this story, and there is a reader who would really benefit from reading it, whether you think so or not, you have to find those readers. So instead of saying I'm marketing it and you feel bad about that, do your work to find the reader. So, again, leaving bookmarks, sending postcards to find this reader that this book is really going to help, even if you don't think so in some kind of way,
mm-hmm.
it might. You gotta. So instead of marketing, you can see it. I'm going to find the right readers for the book, and I have to get out here, and I have to find them, and then they will they'll benefit from reading the story. We are so blessed, you guys, to have Colleen Parkinson here with us on Off the Shelf this morning. She is an award-winning author of the plays The Injured Child and Waiting for the Train. She's working on a new novel. She expects it out in about a year and a half. She's also a blogger and a book reviewer. She's done reviews for the Mississippi Rag. The Finest Hat in the Whole World is her debut novel. And if you came in on the interview midway or late, when it finishes streaming, you can listen to it its entirety and learn more about The Finest Hat in the Whole World. What the title she's come up with, and Waiting for the Train, that really piqued my interest when you listen to her talk about that story as well. And she is loves music, particularly during the 1920s, 1940s. And please visit her online at thefinesthat.jimdo.com. That's J-I-M as in mother, D as in David, O.com. We want to thank Colleen for being here with us on Off the Shelf, and we want to thank all of you, our Off the Shelf listeners, for being here with us. I hope those of you who celebrate Christmas, whether you're just going to give yourself an experience, you and your family, or getting gifts, or doing both, that you get out and finish it up so you don't put too much stress on yourself, because we are only 10 days away. So thank you for tuning in to Off the Shelf. See you here on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Please, please, please put this on your schedule. You're going to catch Off the Shelf, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and bless yourself. Let yourself be blessed with what our guests share from Off the Shelf. Thank you, Colleen. To our listeners, remember, you are awesome. You are incredible. You're amazing. Go out and create a fabulous day for yourself. And, Colleen, I'll shoot you an email. Bye for now.